Hey, Brides, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Cochran, Judge Eve, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Good morning. You can be seated. Well, as I said, good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, May 2nd, 2024, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have five cases on our calendar today, three of which are scheduled for oral argument. I'm Judge Wheelock, and I'm presiding today on a panel with Judge Cochran and Judge Eade. And this morning, we're holding our arguments in the Olmsted County Government Center in Rochester. Oral arguments are recorded by the court. The audio recording will be available on the branch's website within about 24 hours. And let's see. With that, Marshall, please call the first case before us.
Case file 823-1484, State of Minnesota, respondent, Nicholas John Volker, appellant.
Okay. Now, counsel, as you probably know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Can you both see the timer up here?
Yes.
Okay, so
I couldn't help but know, I think the name tags are misplaced on there. And for the benefit of our studio audience, we might check that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
So the timer will reset according to what you have available for your argument. And then for the purposes of our audio recording, if you could each introduce yourself at the beginning of your turn to speak, pronounce your name and your client's name so we know how you'd like us to pronounce that and refer to you. And counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dan McIntosh. I'm here representing appellant today, Mr. Nicholas Wolter. Mr. Wolter is asking this court to reverse his conviction for violating the order for protection that was issued in this case because the evidence presented at trial was insufficient to prove the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, due to the stipulations that were made prior to the trial, the elements that are contested here, really the third and fourth, the third being that whether the state proved that Mr. Wolter violated a specific term or condition of the order for protection, and the fourth being whether any acts he made constituted a knowing violation of the order. The district court identified three different grounds on which it based its verdict. The first being that there was an intentional obstruction of Ms. Wolter's path of travel. The second being that Mr. Wolter was in close or immediate proximity to Ms. Wolter, and that was applying the definition of contact under the state versus Phipps definition that's been cited throughout the briefs. And the third was that Mr. Wolter engaged in conduct that was indirect contact with Ms. Wolter by making the video that was introduced at trials Exhibit 11. And I want to address each of those just a quick aside for a moment. This is a case where the best laid, best written orders don't always account for what goes on in life. We have an order for protection, we have a parenting time order, and even if well written and well intentioned, life goes on as these orders, after these orders are issued. There was a foundation here for how Mr. Wolter was to conduct himself when he was supposed to have parenting time. And on October 12th, 2022, the Wolter's daughter decided she did not want to go with Mr. Wolter. And as anyone who has kids knows, that the best laid plans can be derailed by the whims of a child. And we're certainly not blaming the daughter by any means here, but that was a wrinkle that came up with these folks and changed the plan, changed the arrangement for that night. Mr. Wolter did not and could not communicate with his ex-wife regarding this change in plan. She told him what may happen. He did not go force his daughter to get in the car with him. He did not cause a scene here. He made sure that she was accounted for, was with her mother, that they were going to leave, and he left. And we're suggesting to you that in the course of that, he did not violate this order. So I want to start with this idea that Mr. Walter intentionally obstructed Ms. Walter's path of travel. And that was important both to the district court's findings and the state's arguments on appeal. And first, I would point out that there's no provision in the order for protection that talks about paths of travel. So if there was an obstruction of a path of travel, that would have to be tied to some other conduct that's specifically accounted for in the order for protection.
I mean, we're talking just broadly about no contact, right? I mean, I think the district court's order pretty clearly framed the issue as the violation arising from not following the no contact order in its most broadest statement.
I agree, Your Honor. And I think that it was tied to the intentional obstruction of the path is tied to this proximity issue. And maybe they're not quite even separate issues, but I do agree that it's contact that's at issue.
But isn't it, and I noticed this in your briefing, the actual conclusion of law in paragraph 4, the district court both referred to Mr. Walter bringing himself into immediate proximity, which seemed to be the focus of your argument, but also creating an unnecessary interaction. And the interaction language is consistent with Phipps in defining what contact is, right?
Correct.
So I'm wondering if you could, and I understand your argument about immediate proximity. He never got out of the car. And that's consistent with the way parenting time exchanges were to occur at the police station. But I'm wondering what your thoughts are on whether or not this was an unnecessary interaction, because unlike a lot of other cases that come before the court, the entire conduct essentially is captured on video. And so why shouldn't we consider Mr. Walter stopping his car at about 20 seconds into the video behind Ms. Walter's car and remaining there for about 14 seconds or longer? Why shouldn't we consider that an interaction?
Well, there's a couple of things with that, Your Honor. The district court did find that there was no indication of any gestures, nonverbal communication. Phipps is getting at with an interaction, there seems to have to be a two-way correspondence here. There was never any communication between the two of them. So as Phipps-
But does it need to be that to violate the terms of the order for protection? Let's say hypothetically that Mr. Walter had encountered Ms. Walter in an alley and there was no way out of the alley except for her to walk past him. And he's standing at the front of the alley and he stops there and keeps her there for a period of 14 seconds. Why wouldn't that be considered a violation of the no contact order?
Well, there's nothing in that situation. They're face to face. There's a lot more communication that's exchanged
without any communication. Nothing said. He's just standing there blocking her from leaving the alley. Why wouldn't that be a violation of the OFP?
Well, I guess I just go back to the Phipps definition and what looking at it in context with everything that's included within Phipps. You know, connection, interaction, communication, that's the final phrase, which seems to require that there's some interpersonal correspondence going on here.
So, doesn't Phipps also include the state of immediate proximity?
Yes.
And that was one of the findings by the district court for concluding there was a violation that when defendant brought himself into in paragraph 4, the court says, in this case, the defendant brought himself into immediate proximity and created an unnecessary interaction.
Right. And I think it is tied together. That's an interesting issue on the proximity part of this, because the district court also found and said if he hadn't stopped, this would be a different case. And so if you drive by the end of the car slowly, you're in the same distance proportion as if you stop. So the distance itself, I don't think can be the determining factor. And I'm not sure what the court, district court meant when he said that this would be a different case, but the stopping in and of itself put him in no closer proximity than if he had driven by.
But would it prevent her from leaving?
Well, that's a matter of contention, I think, Your Honor. And I believe that the district court made a factual error in finding on this point. The district court said that as Mr. Walter pulled up, Ms. Walter's reverse lights were already on and he stopped her from her path of travel. That's just not borne out in the video. There's no reverse lights on until that 34 second mark that Your Honor has already identified.
And but isn't it reasonable to infer from the fact that, so I've watched the video many times and we see the rear lights of Ms. Walter's video as Mr. Walter's pulling up behind it. We don't see the lights for a large portion of the video for about, I think it's from 20 seconds all the way to 34 seconds into the video. But by the time the camera pans back, the reverse lights are already illuminated, as you identified in your brief. And I think it seems unreasonable to assume that the moment he panned over with his camera was the moment she illuminated her reverse lights, given the other testimony,
right?
And what would be a reasonable inference from that. And so I think that, the idea maybe that to say that her reverse lights were illuminated the entire time is incorrect, but certainly it's longer than just a few seconds you've characterized it to be in your brief.
But if you go back to the testimony that Ms. Walter made, she's talking about the child gets in, getting buckled in. She goes to reverse and look back. And that's the point at which she even sees him there. She then puts the car back into park. So I agree with you. It wasn't instantaneous of turning the camera, but even by Ms. Walter's testimony, she puts the car in reverse, sees him there, puts it back in park. I mean, that's a fairly quick turnaround.
Why isn't that enough? Even if it's, I mean, so I understand. I mean, this is an interesting case because the entire interaction is so brief.
Right.
And even if we agree with you that it's a very brief interaction, why isn't, I mean, other types of conduct can be, or contact can be a single word. You know, sure. if he yelled a word, it just take, a foul name at her, that would just be 1 second. And that would clearly be a violation. You would agree?
Yes. If it's a verbal communication that's delivered directly to someone, it wouldn't matter if it was one word or 10 minutes of talking, it certainly would not.
So why wouldn't conduct of blocking her into the space and holding her there when, it would be unreasonable to infer that he didn't know it was her vehicle that his child had just gotten into? You would agree?
He definitely knew it was her vehicle. I mean, there's no question about that.
And so why should we view this kind of conduct any different than a single word, even though this was very brief interaction?
Well, there's two reasons for that. One is this proximity issue. And if he's not in immediate proximity, there's no contact. And I understand your point about the interaction. Because of Ms. Walter's testimony, she wasn't even aware of him until she puts the car in reverse and then goes back.
I thought it was she became aware of him when her daughter said, "Mr. Walter's behind."
That was all in her testimony. My understanding is that was all at the same moments. I mean, they're both perceiving this, but Ms. Walter says she looks back, sees him, puts the car back in park. But the second part of this is Ms. Walter's testimony was that I put the car in reverse, and that was obviously indicating I was going to back up. That's the only point at which her path of travel was identified, because the testimony and the video shows she could drive forward, she could drive back. She wasn't under a duty to do either one, but she wasn't pinned.
I agree with you there, because you can see clearly on the video that even if we assume she would have been able to drive forward, there was a car that was pulling out as Mr. Walter's starting to drive away. So why would it be reasonable to infer that path of travel forward was clear when we have her reverse lights illuminated, It's clear from the beginning of the video that Mr. Wolter drives up and there's nothing obstructing Ms. Wolter from leaving at that point. And so why are we to assume that he would not have known what her path of travel was given those circumstances, the circumstances proved?
Well, the picture here is Mr. Wolter has got, he's got care of this child this evening. He follows, the girl comes out, walks to the right, gets her mother's car. He still doesn't know at that point if the plan is she's leaving with mother, she's leaving with me, because he can't correspond. The mother never closed the loop. When she puts her car in reverse, that's indicating I'm leaving and I want to move out. I can agree with that. And that's the point at which he leaves.
Well, he was there longer than, I mean, I've watched the video several times too, and I want to focus a little bit on what you just said though. And in your brief, I think you make a similar statement that mother's, you know, going in, putting the car into reverse and the reverse lights coming on signals something to father. I think you're saying that she wanted to leave at that point. Is that correct?
That was her characterization of her own.
Well, in your brief, you say thus the reverse lights not only signal Ms. Wolter's desired path of travel, but also signaled that Ms. Wolter was leaving with their daughter. So signaling, you're arguing that the movement of a car is communication in your brief by Ms. Wolter. Why isn't the same true of Mr. Wolter when he pulls up behind her and stays there and blocks her path?
I was speaking regarding her own characterization of her testimony, and it's on page 74 of the transcript. She's saying that was my indication I was going to leave. He did understand that and he left. He didn't make a similar act though towards her that would communicate any message or any intention. He stopped, the daughter gets in, Ms. Wolter indicates she's going to leave, and he drives off. I mean, those facts are pretty much uncontested. And I mean, we are dealing with
it communicate to her that he is there and she can't leave while he's back there?
Well,
I mean, why isn't that a communication in immediate proximity? Help me understand that.
Well, it's not immediate proximity because they're physically separated. Maybe just finish the thought.
Yes, please do.
They're physically separated by both their cars and a distance. If you look at the FIPS definition, the immediacy has to be touching or immediate proximity. And there's just no way in which he was physically able to be in that close of space. The other part of it is just stopping his car. This gets into the circumstantial evidence part of this, because the reasonable hypothesis is just as equally plausible that he's making sure the daughter's accounted for. He leaves. They are able to leave. And this started obviously with an embellishment by Ms. Wolter that she was pinned in for 5 minutes. That's what got this case going. That just never happened. And what he did, we believe, is reasonable in terms of he's there. He sees the daughter is not coming to him. She gets in the car. When Ms. Wolter puts on the reverse lights, he leaves. We don't believe there's any communication that's part of that. There's no gestures that were found by the district court, anything like that. And so we're asking the court to find that there was not contact.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
So we'll next turn to counsel for respondent. There will be 15 minutes added to the clock. And counsel, you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is James Haas. I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. In the time I have with you this morning, I'd like to hit upon sort of two major points. I'd like to provide clarity as to the state's position on appeal and make a few concessions along the way to maybe put a finer point on, you know, where the state's position is on appeal. And secondly, I'd like to take a step back and talk about the totality of the circumstances to include the history of the relationship and how it puts this instance into context and how it supports the trial court's verdict here. First of all, there was an alternative position advanced by the trial prosecutor that this instance, taken in consideration with a series of instances, formed a pattern of harassment. And that was supported, that was advanced upon some of the evidence of prior claims that Mr. Walter's electronic communications had exceeded the scope. I'll tell you that I'm not advancing that argument on appeal. I didn't in my brief. And moreover, the district court really didn't address it. Now, this court is free to consider it, and you're not certainly bound by my lack of argument, but
what about your argument though that that there was a gesture here? I thought the district court specifically found that there was no gesture, and yet in your brief you argue that there, you know, the facts support finding of a gesture. So isn't your argument inconsistent with the district court's findings?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Maybe in the words of George Gershwin, sort of a you say tomato, I say tomato. The district court looked at this filming as an indirect contact. In her testimony, Mrs. Walter referred to it as a gesture. My position is the order itself clearly prohibits any gestures. If Mr. Walter would have simply waved at her in a friendly fashion, as I'm doing now, I think that would be a gesture and a clear violation.
But that's not, what's the legal basis for considering filming as indirect contact? I mean, typically when we think of indirect contact in these terms, we think of Mr. Walter, for example, asking someone else to tell Ms. Walter something, right? Or using social media to communicate, or email or text. I mean, even the email or text might be considered direct contact. Here we have Mr. Walter on the scene with Ms. Walter and then holding up the phone. Why should we conclude that the district court was correct in characterizing holding up the phone and filming as indirect contact? There's no intermediary there.
I agree with the court's definition, and I would say the district court mislabeled what that was. The district court clearly was concerned and found it that it violated the order by his filming her. I think the district court made a poor choice of words, because I agree, typically we think of indirect contact as soliciting some other person to have direct contact. And that was what this, you know, Christensen case talked about, where there was filming the neighbors from across the street in the cul-de-sac. And they were, this court was looking at that term indirect contact. So I would say the district court used the wrong word choice. But I think what the district court was trying to say was this filming, the district court called it indirect, but there, as you say, there was no intermediary. But the court can see it. It's there in the record, and there's no dispute of how that occurred. So, you know, maybe backing up to what I was going to say about that. Frankly, I'm not offended by Mr. Walter pulling in behind her and pausing just briefly. As, you know, counsel points out quite fairly, it wasn't clear whether the daughter was going to jump out of mom's car and jump into dad's car. That's kind of what we would think, that mom's saying, hey, you don't get to decide this. We're the parents.
And Ms. Walter never actually sent a follow-up Our Family Wizard communication saying, daughter is going to be coming with me.
Correct. Correct. So I don't find it unreasonable nor criminal for Mr. Walter to pull in and stop very briefly. But where it starts to cross the line is the duration that he remains behind the vehicle, particularly when the daughter does not get out. The brake lights illuminate on Mrs. Walter's car, and he stays. Not only does he stay, but he pulls out his phone, mine of which is turned off, and holds it up, as I'm doing now, to the court. That changes the dynamic. That changes.
Why isn't appellant's rational, why isn't appellant's alternative hypothesis a rational hypothesis consistent?
I'm sorry, in which the alternative hypothesis that?
That father was just making sure the daughter got in the car and was okay and was waiting to, you know, until he had seen her in the car and took a moment to record that and then left to, you know, to show that given there was no response by mother on our family wizard to, you know, just confirm that that's what he was doing.
And I agree with that suggestion for the first couple of seconds, for a short period of time. What I'm arguing is that the duration of this crossed over that line of reasonableness. It became apparent and clear, I think, at least to the trial court, that the child was not getting out of the car, that the child was going to go home with mother. And we see that when her brake light or her reverse lights appear and she's trying to back up. At that point, it should have been clear to the appellant that the child was not coming home with him. And that's his cue to leave the area.
But isn't it Mr. Walter's argument that essentially that's what he did just a few seconds after the brake lights were illuminated?
I disagree that because he stayed there and pulled out his phone so he could make a video of this.
So
maybe for a child custody dispute to follow, visitation to say, look what she's doing. She's keeping my child from me and I'm recording all of this. But I would argue this is communicative. This is a gesture. And it expands the duration of that contact to the point where it crosses the line.
Well, would it have mattered?
Oh,
go ahead, Jim.
In your view, what does the video show about how long Mr. Walter was there knowing that, well, you said the duration is what matters. So what is the duration that's at issue here? At what point in the video does it start and end?
I would say the absolute line of departure is where Mrs. Walter's reverse lights are illuminated. Which
and that's
you can
at
see.
34 and, seconds or 20 seconds?
Well,
because you see lights on at about 20 seconds. Are those reverse lights? That's what I mean, I think appellant's arguing no, but yeah. It seems like you're arguing that those are reverse lights.
And
otherwise, the period is very short.
And to be clear, the word I think of reverse lights are that sort of opaque or clear lights above the red lights below.
Okay.
Just so we're talking about the
same. So at 20 seconds, you see red lights, I believe.
I would call them more of a white, clear, you know, it's the light above the normal tail running lights.
At 20 seconds?
You know, I don't have the actual timeline in front of me, Judge, and Your Honor can see it. But my recollection is when he initially pulls up behind her and the camera's facing forward, I did not see what I'm referring to, just so we're clear, the reverse lights, which are the ones above, at least from, that's the ones I'm referring to, the sort of white light or clear. Maybe I'm not using the right color, but the lights below it are red. There are more of the tail light running lights that were on the entire time. The reverse lights are above it. I didn't see those on when he initially pulls in behind her. And we don't know when they came on because, as Judge Eade points out, the camera's facing forward and we can't determine when they came on. But I think when the camera panned over and we could see it, I think is when.
Counsel, is this a situation where we should be parsing the number of seconds that somebody was behind someone? We touched on the circumstantial evidence standard, which I think we're going to end up needing to apply here because it's in the context of the OFP. It's in the context of the previous behavior. It's in the context, and my understanding of the OFP is that it prohibited him from slowing down and stopping even in front of the house, the residence. So how do we incorporate those pieces of information beyond the number of seconds that somebody was stopped?
Well, in the first instance, if the court finds that his remaining behind for several seconds and filming her is a gesture, the court need not parse this out as to contact. So that's point number one.
But to go that route, wouldn't we have to find that the district court's finding that there was no gesture was clearly erroneous?
Well, I think the court could find that the district court used improper word choice or maybe, but I think that's what the district court meant. In other words, it wasn't a touching contact. It wasn't maybe an in-your-face contact, but it was it enhanced the nature of that interaction.
But I don't understand why you think that matters, because your argument, as I just understood you to make it, was that it was the point that the rear lights were illuminated that the contact really happens, right? And I'm assuming you're not arguing that if Mr. Wolter had never moved his vehicle to the place that he moved it, which was behind Ms. Wolter's, and he'd stayed where he was at the beginning of the vehicle and filmed the entire thing, you wouldn't argue that would be a violation of the OFP, correct? Because that would be more of the Christensen type situation, right?
Yes. I think, again, we're dealing with relative proximities. I would say certainly if he was across the street, you know, the same distance we're talking about in Christensen and surreptitiously filming her. Here's another one, like more like Christensen. If Mrs. Wolter had gone into the Jets to find her daughter and he was filming her empty car without her presence, similarly to Christensen, where he's just filming the house where nobody was around or outside, that would not be a violation.
So isn't the real inflection point where she's trying to leave and he's blocked her in?
I think it's a culmination when, under the totality of the circumstances, of proximity, duration, and intensity. And all those factors combine to cross the line. It's the closeness he is to her. It's the duration that he spends in proximity to her. And it's what he's doing while he is in that close proximity. All of that, under the totality of the circumstances, I argue, merges to support the district court's verdict. And in that, I have about 3 minutes left. I did want to take a step back and talk about context. And I think that's important here. We have the actual orders for protection themselves, which discuss the history of the relationship and what led to those orders in the first place. And the court can take that into account when considering the history of the relationship. We also have the evidence that was submitted under Minnesota Rule 6 or Statute 634.20, the four instances where Mrs. Wolters had reported to the authorities that the electronic communications with Mr. Wolter had exceeded the scope of the order, and her reaction by calling the police. And what does that, how does that help illuminate the relationship? Well, one, we know that Mr. Wolters should be pretty aware of the contours of this order. He's been called on it numerous times and having to talk to the police about it. It certainly sheds light on how Mrs. Wolters perceives any contact with Mr. Wolters that may exceed the scope. And it certainly demonstrates that Mr. Wolters is willing to get right up to the line and maybe cross that line. And I think that history of the relationship is important for the context of, you know, what could seemingly be a, you know, relatively innocent, maybe inadvertent contact here. If this were Mr. Wolter's first time up to bat, maybe a recent order, you know, frankly, I don't think we'd be here. I'd be surprised if it were charged.
Well, it seems like you're also conceding that it might not have been charged if Ms. Wolter hadn't characterized it as 5 minutes of being trapped in the parking space from the beginning. And if everyone had known it was just a few seconds, the state might not have charged it either.
Well, I mean, I'd be speculating that, but I that's not an unfair observation. And frankly, I when this hit my desk, I went and talked to Ms. Whitney, who was the prosecutor, about it. I said, tell me about this case. And it was then that I thought that the history and the context of the relationship was important. And, this wasn't the first time this all had happened. And while it may be a seemingly technical violation, the state's position and the district court found that the culmination of the proximity, the duration, and the intensity, what was happening during that time, exceeded the scope of the court's order.
Can you briefly address appellant's argument that that they weren't in immediate proximity because, you know, the court said if he had just been driving by that there wouldn't have been a violation, so the distance of the car isn't sufficient to show immediate proximity?
Well, I think, as I've alluded to earlier, if he would have just driven past, that proximity in and of itself, I personally wouldn't find it to violate the terms of the order. But as I've stated, I think it's the merger, the totality of the relative proximity, the duration, and the intensity, the gesture that occurred, then upon which I'd respectfully ask the court to affirm the conviction.
Okay, thank you, counsel. And we will turn to counsel for appellant for the last word. There will be 5 minutes on the clock. And you can begin when you're ready. And the clock is set.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll try to be very brief. I think the state's arguments really highlight what a razor thin case this is in terms of whether there's a violation. I would just point out a couple things here. The district court's conclusion of law number four, as Your Honors have already identified, not only indicated that there was no gestures, also indicated there was no other nonverbal communication. And that's at most what we have looking from the questions earlier about whether the act of stopping was in some way a communication. The district court found there was no other nonverbal communication. The district court found the indirect contact based on the video, which we suggest is an error based on that Christensen case, and the court found immediate proximity, which we also suggest is error and maybe is conceded at this point.
Ask you just to clarify, I heard you spend most of your argument today on the contact issue, element three, and perhaps because of our questioning, you haven't gotten to element four, that Mr. Wolzer knew or believed that his conduct or understood an aspect of his conduct to be a violation of the order. In the model jury instruction, there's a citation, I think, that you point out to State v. Anderson, which was a case about the harassment restraining order not setting forth the actual address. It was a confidential address of the protected party. And that doesn't seem at all to be analogous to the situation here. As you conceded in your initial argument, Mr. Wolzer knew this was Ms. Wolzer's car. He knew that it was his daughter getting into the car. He knew that he wasn't allowed to have contact with Ms. Wolzer. It seemed to me that your briefing aimed this argument at the direction of travel issue, that he, and you alluded to this in your opening argument, that there's nothing about inhibiting or preventing direction of travel. But really, isn't the focus of your argument on the contact issue, whether or not this is contact? Because very clearly, and you agreed in the hypothetical that if you had stood at the end of an alleyway, that would have been a violation of an order for protection. So it doesn't seem like there's anything unknown in the same way that Anderson was decided that implicates element four here in terms of what you're arguing. Am I right about that?
I disagree on one point there, because the district court in issuing the order had carved out this idea where when there are child exchanges, Mr. Wolzer was to stay in his car, child is exchanged, he goes on his way. Now, this obviously didn't occur at the St. Charles Police Department. I suppose he could have forced the daughter into his car and gone and exchanged her at the police department. But the court had carved out this situation where he was allowed to be in the area in his car during a child exchange. And Ms. Wolzer concedes that that's what this became, was a de facto exchange of the child, custody between them. And so with the court carving out that exception when children are being exchanged, I think it's reasonable that he can assume if I stay in my car, the child's exchanged, I account for her whereabouts, and I go on my way, that can't be a violation.
And all of that does sound very reasonable. But the issue is that just as true at the police department as it was outside the gymnastics location, it's the blocking her in. And that's the contact issue, element three. So I'm just trying to figure out if I'm correct that that's the focus of your argument rather than some sort of knowledge issue as to element four.
Well, I think it has to all go together, because his knowledge is based on what the orders have dictated to him. And there is some disagreement here on the duration or the quote unquote blocking in. We believe it was very short, and in fact, no more time than him to just put his car in reverse and leave. And then Ms. Wolzer is there. She could drive forward, she could reverse. So the blocking in, it does get somewhat to a time factor, because things can't happen instantaneously. She puts on her lights. He does take the short video, but he's moving within 3 to 5 seconds, I think. And that was testified to by the detective Rademacher as well, that it was a very short time period from his understanding. So I think the knowledge part does factor in to the extent there was a condition that dealt with child exchanges and him staying in his car, which he did do. And I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for the briefing and the argument here today. It's been very helpful. We will issue an opinion in the case within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.